Welcome back. So we are took our break. I hope you guys had time to digest a little bit what we talked about. We talked a lot about, you know, the foundation of XAML, where does it come from? It's extensible, it's a serialization language and all that. And now we'll take a look at some of the more, I would say, more of the UI features, a little bit looking under the hood of XAML. We are going to start with brushes, and brushes are, we saw already a couple of examples, like, you know, background equals green, but that's kind of, you know, the boring example, right? So let's see what we can do with brushes. So before we start talking about brushes, I think it's important to understand colors in XAML. And color is, you know, it's a structure, it's actually using RGB, so the red, green, and blue channel, and then there is an A, which is the alpha channel, which is transparency. So everything is coded with 16 bits per channel. So it's a really a very, very high definition color. You may remember that back then we had true color, which was 24 bits altogether. And now we have, of course, you know, 3 times 16 bits, right, in order to code those colors. So we have a very, very high definition. The transparency also goes between 0 and 2055. So if you want
255.
What did I say?
2000.
Oh, yeah. 255. So if you want to have something which is like half transparent, you set it to 128. Of course, we code that typically in hexadecimal. So we go from 0 to FF. You can also write, just like in HTML, by the way, you can also write the 8-bit representation. So you, instead of having FF, you can actually write F, just 8-bit. And when you try to take a brush or a color from HTML and put it into XAML, it's actually going to work because HTML doesn't have the alpha channel. And XAML understands if you leave out the alpha channel, the first 255 bits, this is going to be totally okay in XAML as well.
Yep. And we also have opacities. So
yes,
if you want to use, you know, a, like RGB like format, and you just want to use opacity for your alpha, like
yeah,
to do transparency, you can do that.
Yeah.
So you have a true alpha channel, and then any UI element, anything that you can paint on the screen for us in XAML will have an opacity property.
Correct.
That you can use for transparency too.
Yeah, the big difference between opacity and the alpha channel is that the alpha channel applies to whatever is painted with that brush, mm-hmm, but not to the children of that element, while
exactly,
the opacity is actually inherited. So if you have a grid and you set the opacity of this grid to 50%, all the children will have an opacity of 50%, which, by the way, is probably a scenario which happens actually more often than setting the alpha channel. But, you know, it's good to have it for special cases when you want to have a transparent or half-transparent background, but the children really fully opaque.
Yep. Power and flexibility. You're going to hear us talk about that a lot.
Hopefully. Okay, so here we have an example on the screen of a simple brush. So this is just to give you an idea. It starts with a hash sign, just like in HTML. And then the first FF is the transparency. So here, FF meaning fully opaque. So this is 100%, you know, opacity here. And then you have the second FF, which is the R channel. You have the 00, which is, and I see that it actually doesn't match. It should be 0000FF. I'm not sure why the code is wrong here. Anyhow, the last FF is the one which is important. This is a blue channel. And here I write also the word blue, because as we said before, we have type converters, so I can actually write a word. And this is going to be, as long as it is inside the enumeration of all the colors, it will be actually recognized. And there are really tons of those colors. I remember seeing sable, one which is kind of a light beige type thing. Another example here, so as soon as you have R and G and B at the same value, this is going to be gray. 00000 being totally black, and of course FFFFF being totally white, and then you have all the shades of gray in between. And that is here an example. I'm not sure if there is a name for that particular color. I didn't look, but basically you can just type the code, and that's fairly easy. And here we have, and that's a bad example again. Here we have an example where I actually change the alpha channel, so the first number should read 80 instead of what we have here.
We'll try those again in Blend in a few
minutes. Yeah, we'll show some samples. Don't fret. Anyways, this slide is actually better prepared. So here are a few examples. Here I have totally white. Notice that the background, the grid that I have in the background has a gradient. There is a reason to that. It's just to show you the transparency. But the element here doesn't have a gradient. It is really a solid color brush, which means that it is taking a color, and I'm using this color to paint my element. Here I have red, I have a shade of blue, and here I have transparent. Now, transparent is actually an interesting side edge case, I would say, because there is a difference if you paint an element with a transparent brush or if you don't set the background. If you don't set the background, your clicks, your mouse clicks are actually going to go through the element. While if you set a transparent brush, it's actually going to acknowledge the clicks. So that is something which is very useful, especially when you develop for a small screen like the phone, where you want to increase the size of the touch area. You can put your element, your visible element, which is tiny, inside a grid, set the background of this grid to transparent, and this way when you tap on the grid, even if you're not exactly on the element, it's still going to acknowledge the touch. When we use brushes in Blend, I'm going to show you some demos later. You can, of course, type everything in XAML, but if you go to Blend, here we have the UI. This is the palette that you have. You can see here the RGB channel with the alpha channel. This is the result below. Don't be confused. The first FF is the alpha channel and not the last one. So this is really the first here. You can actually select another color system such as CMYK, but to be clear, XAML uses RGB, so everything is going to be converted back to RGB. Yep. Using HLS, HSB, or CMYK can be useful when you are reading some comps from designers who use that coloring system or that palette. Then you can easily convert using this feature of Blend. Brushes can be used for a number of things, and typically when we work with shapes and paths, like I'm going to show you in a moment, we have fill, we have stroke, we have another special one called opacity mask. I'm going to get back to that in a minute. In buttons, you have background, you have border brush, you have the foreground for the text. So you have all kinds of brush, and of course you can also, when you create your own control, use brushes for other purposes. We will see a little bit later how to build custom controls and how to use them. You can also use resources. So in WPF, you have a large number of system resources, which are listed here. When you go to the phone, you also have your resources. Like, for example, there is one which is very useful, which is the phone accent brush. Phone accent being when you change the theme of your phone as a phone user, you can actually select, for example, mine one is magenta because I rock that this way. I don't know why. You can choose blue, red, whatever. This color is accessible to you in your application as a resource, which means that as a developer, you can select that resource. And then when the user goes into the settings of his phone and changes the color, this color will automatically appear in your application. So think about it. It's a nice way to customize your application for the user's taste with some very gentle and very subtle touch, I would say. So that's very cool. We also have gradients, and linear gradient brush is probably the most used. So here we have an example, and if we concentrate on the square in the middle, I go from black to white. So I just have two gradients here. And XAML, or you know, the rendering engine, is actually doing the work of translating that neatly. Here is another example. A gradient doesn't just have gradient points, but it also has an orientation. So you have also a vector component with a start point and an end point, which tells you the direction. So here I go from 0, 0 to 1, 1 with from black to red, again, two gradient stops. Here is another example, a little bit more fancy. I think this is probably about 8 or 10 gradient stops. And of course, like I said before, the rendering engine is doing the transition between. So you can easily customize that. And you can, of course, play with transparency as well. So here I have, for example, a glass type of effect where I have something which is probably has about 20 or 30% transparency white. And then suddenly I stop with a gradient, and I go to with a gradient stop, and I go to 0%, and it kind of gives you this effect of shading or of, in that case, of glass.
Yep.
Again, we have a palette for that. Again, you can type everything in XAML if you prefer, but if you go into Blend or into Visual Studio Designer, this is how you specify the stop. Each one of these small arrows here is actually a stop. I can probably show here using the cursor. And each one of those arrows has a position which is given from 0 to 1, so from 0% to 100%. Now, of course, customizing all that, and there are really a lot of things that you can customize, start point, end point. You can even customize, you know, the opacity of the actual brush. So in addition to the alpha channels, the brush actually has an opacity. You can do transform to those brushes. This is pretty complicated to set up. But, of course, there is a tool which is really cool, which is going to help you. I'm going to show that in a second. Here we see the XAML which results of that. So like we said before, you can absolutely go ahead and write your whole XAML by hand. This is, of course, a lot of work, and I don't know many people who do that. Now, here we have a good example of the human readability of the code which is generated by the designer. Here we have 0.986. The actual value is probably, 765132, et cetera, et cetera. But for readability purposes, everything is cut to 3 digits after the comma, which, of course, makes things a lot easier to check and to merge when you do some source control. So this is an example which shows that things can get complex quite fast. And this is why we have another tool in Visual Studio Designer and in Blend, which is really convenient, which is this small arrow that you see here on my toolbar. And this arrow is going to actually show the vector on the screen, and then you can customize it. For example, I can go and grab here the end of this vector and move it around. We are going to show that in just a second. Each of those tiny dots here on the vector is one of the gradients of the linear gradient brush. One tool which is really cool, I'm going to show that in a moment, is the eyedropper. You can actually go into Blend, take the eyedropper, and then select any color on your desktop. So it doesn't have to be inside Blend. It can be anywhere in any application. Or using the gradient eyedropper, you can actually select a gradient directly, which is very convenient when you get an Adobe Illustrator comp, for example, which is the case quite often. Instead of going and copying the brush by hand or doing a lot of work, you just go and copy it using the eyedropper. I'm going to demo that at the end. That would be an example. Now, we also have a radial gradient brush, which allows you to do things like that or like this. You can also move the center of the gradient brush to give a little bit some tunneling effect like that. You can also use it to do some glass effect with an added kind of 3D type of effect. So here we are very skeuomorphic and not very authentically digital. But still, I mean, those concepts are very useful when you build, for example, desktop applications. Unfortunately, it's not in Windows Store apps yet, I would say, or at least I hope. I don't know the secrets of the gods. But you can simulate a radial gradient brush with two linear gradient brush on top of each other, things like that. So this is what we have here. Again, there are tools for that, the same tool. And here we see how we can move the gradient stop and also move the center of the gradient using here the end of this arrow. You also have an eyedropper. The eyedropper is a little bit less convenient to use, or maybe a little bit more unusual, because this is, of course, going to convert your line that you draw into a radial gradient brush. So it's kind of a little bit more difficult to understand exactly what happens. But it can be actually useful when you have something like a half circular brush. You can copy it fairly easily. Okay, I mentioned before.
Well, gradients are cool. One thing I'll tell you, because you mentioned, for example, radial gradient is not in WPF.
And not in Windows 8.
It's only in WPF.
It's also on the phone, also on Silverlight, not in Windows 8, right?
And the comment I was going to make actually was, just because you can do gradients doesn't mean you should abuse them. And particularly on phone, think about a phone. It's a very small device, and you don't control the colors. In some cases, they have a lot less colors.
Correct.
So make sure that, if you're going in there and doing some really cool gradients, that you test them out and make sure that you know what they're looking like on the phone, because there's a lot of power behind it, but, on the phone, it cannot look so great.
Correct.
It can kind of get banded. That's why radial gradients and some of those things have not been a priority yet.
Yeah. No, it's a good point, and I think that this illustrates the need to. I mean, if you have the possibility, really work with professionals who are used to that. There is a reason why the Microsoft UI design has simpler colors and strong colors and a lot of typography and all that. It's because this improves the readability quite a lot. And I think that we see now with the latest iOS 7 that even Apple, who was really known for glass effects, for a lot of gradients, a lot of shadows, is shying away from that a little bit. The modern approach being that you rather go for things which are a little bit simpler and more modern. However, it's a good tool to have because you can use it for many things if you want. Yep. Now, opacity mask is also a gradient, but this is something which is a little bit different because we don't care about the R, G, and B channel. We only consider the alpha channel, and that's going to be used for the transparency of an element. So, for example, I can take really any element, could be a video, could be a picture in that case. And here I apply here a radial gradient brush, and we see that at some point it's not actually a clip, it's really the opacity of the element which changes, but you see that it changes to zero, and that allows you to do some cool stuff as well. Opacity mask, as I said, it is a gradient brush, but only the alpha channel is considered, not the rest.
Yep, and it's a brush. It doesn't have to be a gradient, radial. It's just...
It's a brush. It can be anything. Yep. You could have an opacity mask, which is a solid color brush. Of course, it doesn't make any sense because then it would be always, fully opaque. Yep. But that's correct. It doesn't have to be radial. It can be really any brush.
Yep.
This is also not in Windows Store apps for the reasons mentioned before. Now, image brush and video brush are actually a cool thing. Just to illustrate, it's a little bit a special case, but just to illustrate the power of brushes, which is just an element that you use to paint something. And here we have this picture, and I'm using that to paint the text saying image brush. And if you check carefully, you can see actually the picture of this flower used to paint here. So you can use that in WPF and Silverlight. You can do some really cool things. On the phone, it works as well. There is also a video brush. I don't have an example here, but the video brush allows you to even paint with video. And then you can do, for example, some really cool signage type of effects where you have a big text. The text can change dynamically. It doesn't matter. But the background, well, actually the foreground color, the foreground brush of that element is going to be a video which is actually playing. So that's a cool feature. This would be how you do here an image brush in XAML. Or, of course, you have also support in Blend. So here I said only WPF and Silverlight. I just want to underline that this is also in the phone. The image brush is also in the phone, so you can do actually image brushes in the phone. Again, think twice before doing it. It's not very readable. It can actually impair the readability of your app. But if you go on the desktop, then it probably makes more sense.
Yep. And it's video brush. So image brush is everywhere.
Yeah.
It's video brush that's only on WPF. So image brush
and Silverlight. So you can have on Silverlight on the desktop, you can have the video brush as well. Yeah, correct.
Yep.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about shapes. Before we go to the samples, I'm going to do actually demos using shapes and brushes because those two go well together. So we have shapes and paths, and there is a little bit of a difference. So for example, two shapes that we have in XAML are rectangle and ellipse. And you can see that as a high-level path, if you want. So this is here in rectangle, I can set the width and the height. I can even round corners, like this green rectangle is actually still a rectangle object. It's not a path yet. But, the sides have to be parallel, and they have to be at 90-degree angle. You don't have a choice here. When you use a rectangle, this is what you get. Now, in many cases, this is actually sufficient, and in many cases, it makes your life a little bit easier than having a path element. We'll come to path in a moment. An ellipse, a special case of the ellipse is, of course, the circle. When the height and the width are the same, it's still an ellipse element. But using those two elements and combining them, you can actually create really a whole lot of UI elements and a whole lot of things on your background, on your UI. Now you can take things like that and convert to parse. This is a feature of Blend and of the Visual Studio Designer. So right click on the element, say convert to parse. Or you can just go ahead and start, you know, typing your parse in XAML. Or you can import parse from Adobe Illustrator. I'm going to show an example in a moment. Or you can even go in Blend and freehand draw your parse. So there are multiple ways to create parse. Usually I start with shapes, I arrange them a little bit like I want, then I convert them to parse, and then I go in and fine-tune the points.
And our path data format is actually the same format than we use for SVG.
That's correct.
So if somebody has SVG paths, you can just copy and paste them onto SAML, and it's the exact same format.
That's correct, yeah. I'll show an example of this format thing in a moment. So here I converted a few paths. The green one is actually freehand, so I just went, you know, crazy with my stylus on my new beautiful Surface Pro, and I just drew a path. I have here this ellipse that I converted. The orange ellipse is interesting because what I did is that I actually converted to a path and then I removed the point. I'm going to show an example of that in a moment. So it kind of fell with a nice Bezier curve onto itself. The rectangle, the blue rectangle on top, I just took some of the sides, and then I drew some nice Bezier. This is things that you can do very easily. You have tools in Blend to help you with that, the pen and the pencil. And you can also combine paths. So this is something which is very powerful. If I have two paths on top of each other, and this is an ellipse and a rectangle, but they will be converted to paths when you combine them. And then you can unite those two, and then you get one path which has a shape which is the unification of those two. The color depends on the last element that you clicked on, so depending on which element I click on, as the last one is going to change to red or blue. Now, the big advantage of paths over bitmaps is that, of course, this is still vector. This is still something that I can change the color of. I can zoom in and still have the really beautiful. Those are all mathematical operations that are drawn on the screen. So you keep this beautiful crispness that is you know, well known in XAML. You can intersect. So here I get the intersection of both paths. You can subtract one path to the other. Again, which path is going to be subtracted from the other depend on which one you click of the order on which you click on them. And you can also take both and exclude the overlap of the paths. Now here, this white hole in the middle is actually a hole, meaning that if I click on it, my click is going to get through to the element which is below. You can, because you have this feature, you can actually use those paths as clipping paths, which is a neat feature. I here have a video, actually, so it's a media element which is playing. We'll talk about media element a little bit later. And I can put a path on top of it and select clip or make clipping path, and then I will have the video being clipped with, again, the hole in the middle, which is transparent to clicks, to mouse clicks, so I can really do some cool things. This particular here effect doesn't have a practical utility that I can think of, but it is very useful, for example, if you have some media elements and then you want to round corners, you want to give a kind of a special shape to your media element and have the video playing anyway, that can be a useful feature. Again, there are a few features which are not in Windows Store apps for the reason that we mentioned, but this is all coming. I have Parse and Brush demos, so let's take a look here. So what I'm going to do is start here in Blend, and we took a very quick look to Blend, but basically, quickly, I have my panels here. I have here the outline of the document, which in Blend is named Object and Timeline. We're going to play a lot with that in a moment. I have my properties, so if I select any element in Blend, we see the properties appearing. It looks very much the same to Visual Studio for the reason that I mentioned. It is actually Blend running under the cover in Visual Studio as a core visual designer.
But it also looks, if you look at Blend, Blend was a tool that from the beginning we said this is for designers. So if you look at the palettes and the layout, if you're familiar with Illustrator, or in particular with Photoshop, this should be very familiar to any designer.
That's correct.
So this is where you look at it and be like, okay, this is truly optimized. You see the drag and drops, all the operations are truly optimized, so a designer feels at home. You know, they get very detailed, pixel-perfect-like tools, and you know they're going to be very effective at using this tool.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And then the last thing is you have a phone project.
Yes.
Earlier you saw me, I was using Visual Studio. Obviously, on either tool, you can do phone, you can do WPF, you can do Windows Store.
That's true.
So we're just starting for that, for variety, to make sure that we balance it out. And
absolutely.
Get
the only reason why I went with a phone project here is that I thought, what do I do? Oh, I could do a phone project. That's really the only reason here.
Yep.
Okay, very cool. So that's what we have. You mentioned that it is optimized for designers coming from Adobe, and it's true. I mean, if I want to select the direct selection tool, I can type the letter A, which is actually the shortcut from Illustrator. So this is absolutely correct. So here we have the palette that I was mentioning before. Let's do a little bit here I'm going to draw a rectangle on the screen. This is a high-level rectangle. It's not a pass yet. You can see here the type of the element in those square brackets. This is a rectangle. I can set two different brushes on the rectangle, the fill, which is here the white, and the stroke, which is a line defining the rectangle. Let's make the stroke red so that we see a little bit better. It's actually selected, so you don't see it well, but if I remove the selection and zoom in, I'm zooming in here using the wheel of my mouse, so this is a nice experience as well. Then you can see this one pixel line which has been drawn, and here if I select my rectangle again and change the fill, I can here select my element nicely. Here you see the R, G, and B which are changing. There is also the alpha. So for example, if I do this and set the alpha, very nice feature in Blend, I can click in one of those boxes, and then if I have this type of cursor here, I can actually click and drag, which is nice because it allows you to get the values that you want quite precisely. And then we see that the color of the element is changing. It's not just the color. I can actually put an element below here, that element. And now you see that we actually have the element which is half transparent showing up on top of the other. And that's going to be rendered the same on the screen. So here, if I click here on this button, the click is not going to go through because I have something in front, things that you need to think about. Okay, let's talk about the conversion to HLS. So here I can go and see the HLS value. Again, everything which is rendered in XAML is going to be alpha RGB, but I can also go here and type green, enter, and this is converting to the actual color, to the actual code corresponding to the color green. I can select also other system like CMYK. Let's go back to RGB here for clarity. I always have the last color, the last brush that I used, which I can go back to if I want. And here I have this famous eyedropper, so I can take here my eyedropper and go and select, for example, let's do a little bit of cross-platform. I'm going to take the yellow of the Chrome icon here. I'm allowed to say Chrome because I don't work for Microsoft. And now I have this beautiful yellow that I selected. So you can really go outside of Blend and select colors, which is a neat feature. All right, now let's talk about the gradient brush. So I'm going to delete this element, and I'm just going to draw. Mix it a little bit. I'm going to take an ellipse. A neat feature is that it always uses the last brush that you used, which sometimes is annoying because you have to remove it, but very often is actually convenient. I'm going to reset here the element. So now I have no brush, which means that my clicks will go through. My element is transparent not just to the eye, but also to the mouse click. And let's change here to the gradient brush. And now I have a gradient, which again, in the case of the phone, is probably not very indicated, but still it is a possibility. I can add some stops here and change the color of those stops. For example, do something a little bit spacey like that. I call that sunset on the Acapulco Bay. It should be probably reverse, which I can do very easily doing that. So there is here a feature to actually reverse the gradient stops. And like I said before, customizing this, if you check the XAML, which is actually created, it's not super great to customize and to type. So this is why we have those powerful tools, like the tools that I was mentioning before, the gradient tool here, And now I can say, well, okay, I want to have this a little bit like that, for example, or maybe a little bit like that. And then I can go and really arrange like I want, and I can move those gradient stops. Notice that if I move the gradient stop here, it's actually going to move here as well, and my XAML is going to be updated at the same time. All right. Now, you can also do the radial gradient brush, like I mentioned. I'm going to convert this linear to a radial now, and this looks very different. You can change, like I said here, the center of the gradient. I can change the direction. I can very easily customize that. All those features are going to be translated in XAML by a gradient origin and by the angle of here of what I have. I can even make my gradient go outside or take some weird shapes like that, depending on the size that it has. I mentioned the feature that I wanted to show, which is if I go back to linear, I can also go and copy here using the gradient eyedropper. I can actually go and do something funny, like take this gradient, and now it's going to actually copy all the gradient stop and put them into XAML. Now, in that particular case, it doesn't have a practical, really usefulness. But if you think that you get a comp from Illustrator, from the designer very often, which has a very complex gradient as a background of your app, or this button has a gradient, you can actually just go in Illustrator and zip, draw, and then copy this gradient very, very easily into your XAML, which would be a good use case.
Yep. And in Blend, you can open Photoshop and Illustrator files.
That's correct.
So you don't have to go in there. You can just open a Photoshop and or an Illustrator file.
And I'm going to show that in a moment. But this is true. You can actually do that, which is very convenient. Yeah. And that copies the shape, but also the, you know, the attributes, like, for example, the brush and all that.
Yep.
Okay, so this is kind of a crash course brushes. I don't want to spend too much time with that. But for example, if I go here and take the page name, you have this foreground. I can set the foreground to red. This is another brush. And like I mentioned before, if I go and select here in System Resources, the phone accent brush. Now, by default, it happens to be red, so that was not very spectacular. But here in the device element, I can change here the accent property, and I have all the accent properties that the phone has. So I can test my application without actually having to run it, test my pages, and see if it makes sense to use the accent brush for a particular element. All right, opacity mask, like I mentioned before, this is something that I can do. Actually, I would have to show that in WPF. Well, let's keep that for the moment. We can come back to that.
Let's move on so we can get the other ones.
Exactly, that's correct. So I wanted to talk a little bit about shapes. So shapes, you know, very quickly, if I have two shapes on the screen here, okay, it's going to reuse. So let's just switch that to red. And then I'm going to take another shape here. Now, the place where you want to find those combining is either by right-clicking on the group. Here you have the combine menu, and this is going to really convert into a path, or inside object path and object combine, and then you can, for example, unite them. I just want to take this advantage here to show the language that you mentioned before, which is actually coming directly from SVG. So this data element here, which can get quite long depending on the complexity of the path, it's actually a mini language which is defining the arcs and the segments of your shape.
Yep.
This is something that you can copy directly from SVG. Now, if you have an Illustrator element, I don't have actually Illustrator on my machine, but I can import. And if I do import Adobe Illustrator file, that works for for Photoshop. Here I can go to a location where our creative director was nice enough to give me a file here yesterday. And I can double-click this file. And here I see that I have an icon canvas with a layer. Those layers correspond to the Illustrator layer. And then I have multiple paths. So let's take this one, and I can change here the fill to red, for example. I can take here this one and change the fill to blue. And now you see that you have some paths, which are still vector, so it is really beautiful. If I zoom in, you can see that the shape remains absolutely beautiful. You can use that. Or, of course, if you have good reason for that, you can also use bitmaps, and transparency is also supported if you have a PNG, so that would work. But here's the advantage is that you have the full zoom ability, and you can also change the background color very easily like that.
And this is just an importer. So if you tweak the shape here, you change it to red or something, we can export out, but the importing works great.
Correct.
And to go back to the vector versus image, obviously images will be much more performant. So unless you really, really need to zoom in and out or something, vectors might be a little bit of overhead. So keep that in mind as you develop your app.
Yeah, for very small icons which are not zoomed in, I rather recommend going with a PNG route. It makes probably more sense.
Yep.
But as soon as you have zoomability and as soon as you have, as you need to change the color, the background or the foreground color of your path, then vectors might make more sense. All right, so this is what we have. Let's show a quick clipping path example. So I'm going to make a new project, WPF.
We should move on to transitions real quick because we're way behind.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about, so, you know, I wanted to show the clips, but this is really easy. You just take your path and then you select here under the path element. You have here this make clipping path, which here is, of course, disabled because I should have two elements to select in order to be able to make a clip. All right. Now let's talk quickly about the visual tree. Oh, sorry, I have two slides here just showing a little bit like those are media type of elements, right? So I have image and I have the media element, which supports video, so you can play video very easily. Now, one thing which is really cool here is that if you run it on the desktop, it's actually not the Windows Media Player. It is actually its own element. It is a UI element that you can actually transform, rotate, clip, make half transparent, everything. You don't have airspace issues with that element. You can put things on top of it. It works beautifully.
Yep. But it also, it's actually using the Media Foundation. So the Media Foundation engine that we have in Windows, it's actually using that if you're writing a Windows Store app or a WPF app. So if you have a codec installed, you can leverage it from there. So there's kind of a nice synergy there. But you're right that it's not just shelling out to Media Player. You actually have your media element on screen. You can control it. You can go full screen. You can apply any kind of mask or anything like that. You can put items in front of it or behind it. So you get a lot of rich functionality out of that.
Mm-hmm. And you have this element also in the phone, by the way, which can be useful if you want to play, to have the in-page experience of a video playing, so a smaller video player. And then, of course, at some point, you can get the out-of-page experience where you really switch to the full-blown media player. You have here on the screen, you can play video and also audio, by the way. You have APIs, so if you want to build your own UI, you can do that. Start, stop, play, pause, etc., skip, and all that. There are events, so it reacts to mouse, it reacts to touch, and many formats are supported.
We're not going deep into media element here because we kind of want to start to brush with the basic, hey, we got to paint bits on the screen. So we started with brushes and media and images because of that. But, the media element is very rich. DRM, very standard advanced or very advanced trimmings, formats, everything that you would expect out of really rich media is there. All of the formats, WMB, MP4, the most popular standard formats are all supported out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to give you a really deep dive into the media element, but it's something you can definitely go learn on your own once you understand, hey, I just got to look at the class and see the definition.
Yeah.
Very rich media stack.
Correct. Okay, so let's move to transforms quickly. So you can transform elements in XAML, which is quite exciting. It all started with 2D transforms initially. That was the only transforms you could do initially. And those are affine transforms, meaning that parallel side always remain parallel. And you have, of course, the famous SRT, scale, rotate, translate. So I can here take the original element being a little bit darker and then translate it, scale it to something smaller. It doesn't have to be proportional, it could be anything. I can translate an element, so it's really a moving action. So you might ask yourself, why should I choose that instead of setting the margins? Well, simply because transforms are actually optimized for animation. They are much faster than animating the margin. So as soon as you want to do an animation, you should rather use a transform. You also have the rotate that I mentioned, very simple. And then you have a fourth one, which is a skew, so you can take an element and skew it. Like that, you can skew both sides, actually.
So all of our rendering happens to be DirectX at the lowest level.
Correct.
So if you think about the optimization here, having a transform that we can just send onto the GPU, it's much more effective than us doing the transform in software. Mm-hmm. So that's why you want to use transfer for animation in particular.
Correct. So this is a render transform. I'm going to go back to the difference between render and layout in just a second. You can also have a render transform origin. For example, if you think of the rotation example, the render transform origin, if you put it to 0.5, 0.5, right, it's going to be at the center of the element. But I can also put it at 0, 0 and have an element rotate around the top left corner. Now, there are also some non-affine transforms, which we sometimes call 2.5D because it's not real 3D, but it gives an element, an impression of 3D. For example, here I have this dark rectangle, which is kind of falling onto the desktop, and you have this kind of effect. This is, as I said, non-affine. You can select the center of origin, which is going to modify the way that your element. And all those properties can be animated, by the way. So this is, we use, for example, projection transform to navigate to a different page in the phone. You have utilities to do that. But this is really nice because you have really this page turning effect, which is very easy to do with that. I mentioned that most transforms in XAML are render transform. Render meaning that the transform is applied after the layout has been completed. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't affect the layout. For example, this button in the middle, if I rotate it, it's going to appear in front and below. It appears below the button, the next button, because this button is on top of it. I always think of XAML as a 3D experience. You have really this layered experience. As opposed to a layout transform, which will actually be applied before the layout is completed. So it will actually affect the layout. Now, layout transform is a little bit of a special case. It's only available in WPF. It's for very, very powerful applications. Render transform is the one which we use in pretty much every situation, and it actually works well in most scenarios.
Yep. And in that scenario, if you go back to your slide, so the way it works in XAML is, first of all, if you have sibling elements, like, for example, these three buttons right here are kind of inside the same stack panel, so they're kind of siblings on the tree. We're going to talk about the tree next. Mm-hmm. So if we have sibling elements, the one that gets declared last kind of goes in front. But we do support a z-index, so you could actually go back and, for example, set a higher z-index on the middle button.
Correct.
And have it be in front of everything else. So we have a very rich composition engine that where you can control all of these. It's just that this sample was simple enough.
Correct.
Yep.
All right. Let's do a very quick example here, and this is only because I want to show the UI that you have in Blend to allow you to do that. I'm just going to reopen the actual same application. And if I take an element here, I can actually go here, and then there is a transform section. And here I have a UI which is quite convenient. So, for example, this is here a translate. So I can, like I say, translate the element. You see the original position conveniently drawn on the screen. I can go and rotate it, or using this small element here, or I can just type a value. I can scale X and Y, and I can go and skew an element either like that, or here I have a small UI, a small add-oner on the screen, which allows me to do something like that. So really, you have a large way of working. And by the way, once your element has been transformed, then you can also transform it to a pass, like I did before, and then do some more refined operations, I would say. Yep. In XAML, quickly, this is what you get. Every element has a rectangle, has a render transform property, which in that case is expressed with rectangle.renderTransform. And you either have a composition, so there is an element called transform group, which can take after that a scale transform, a rotate transform, a translate transform, or you have the more convenient composite transform, which you can define here with properties, and this is a little bit easier. To apply.
And it's just an aggregation. A composite transform is an aggregation of an SRT.
Correct.
So it has a scale, a rotation, a translate.
And the skew.
Yeah, and the skew. So you can just go back, and it's just the composition, so we don't have to group them. It's a little bit more convenient.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's correct. Now, I mentioned before those 2.5D transforms. So here I have a projection UI, and using this small UI, for example, I can do some cool stuff. Like, for example, I can rotate here the plan in three dimensions, more or less. And then I can here refine it using here X, Y, and Z. for example. So this is pretty convenient. And again, this is a nice UI. In XAML, you will have here the plane projection element, which has rotation X, Y, and Z, and has a few other properties to fine-tune that.
Yep. So on XAML, all of our platforms, WPF, Phone, and Windows Store, they will all have a way to bring DirectX or 3D content onto your scenes. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to talk about it today because that's a little bit more advanced. But WPF has kind of a native 3D support. They have a lot of 3D support there. And then they also allow you to bring DirectX and interoperate, bring it into your app and talk and back and forth between kind of what you're rendering with mm-hmm. and WPF. Mm-hmm. And then Phone and Windows Store take it even farther, and they let you compose where you can bring in kind of DirectX surfaces onto your application and go back and forth. Mm-hmm. So the 2.5D is great for animations, great for controls that kind of need to be kind of like transitions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But you also have the full power of 3D if you're going to do something else.
Correct. Okay. Now the last topic I want to talk about right now is the visual tree. And this is an interesting way to understand what happens when you really render things on the screen, right? So we have two trees in XAML. We have the logical and the visual tree. Now, the logical tree is what you get when you compose your element. So it's really a representation of the XAML. Here I would have a page tag, which is opening, and then I have a grid tag within that page tag, which is also opening. And then I have a button, which is probably self-closing, because here I just set properties. Mm-hmm. And this is here what we call the logical tree. Now, you have to think that in order to draw a button, and we'll talk more about that when we talk about templates, in order to draw a button, I have to tell the framework, what composes this button, right? And this is what we call template. So here I have a template which has a grid, which has a border with a content presenter. And I also have two rectangles here, the focus visual for white and the focus visual for black, because you can have a black or white theme. And of course, when you compose that inner XAML with this outer XAML, then you get what we call the visual tree. There is a tool which is absolutely fantastic to help you understanding the power of the visual tree. It's called XAML Spy. There is the URL down there. I can really recommend it because it helps you to debug visually your UI. And think about all those cases where you are, oh, I have actually 10 pixels on the right and only 8 on the left, and I want 10 on both. Why do I have only 8 on the left? What is messing things up? Well, you can fire up here XAML Spy and go and check it out. Here in that case, I have the text block inside the template of the button, which is selected. We see here the red, and I can even go ahead and change the properties here at runtime, which is actually pretty cool. Let's show a quick example of that. I have XAML Spy here. I'm going to go to apps and select here an application that I have. It is actually connecting to the emulator. And this is all in real time. So if I open here, you see that there are quite a lot of elements composing that. For example, I have here the title here, my application. If I change things, for example, if I go and select here the checkbox and I look for the is checked property. I don't quite find it here. But here it is. Is checked is set to false. But if I set my element here to true, I probably have to refresh. But basically, I will see that it changes to true, yep. Etc. And here I see conveniently drawn which element I'm talking to. Now, you can do some really crazy stuff because, Blend is, for example, WPF, right? So if I select WPF, I can actually go ahead and attach XAML Spy to Blend. And I can do some funny things, like, for example, here on the small screen, it's a little bit difficult, but if I go and select here this element up here, so you see the red drawing here. Now I see all the values here, and I can, for example, change here the corner radius, so I have 4400. Let's set everything to 20, and now I have something which will actually look different. It's not super visual here, but you can really, have the whole power of attaching to your elements, going in real time to modify them.
Yep. And this concept of the visual tree is very, very important. We're getting to the kind of what we call the foundation, the underhood of XAML. This concept is very important because, as you see next, we're going to start about talking about things that trickle down an app to Visual 3. So, you know, in SuperLight and like Windows Store phone, we almost don't use the logical tree term a lot. We use this whole term of Visual 3 a lot. And these are going to be things that trickle back and forth. You'll see here in a minute when I talk about events, when I talk about resources, everything will trickle back and forth on the Visual 3. So this is where we're going under the hood and we're starting to go into the fundamentals. And we're going to go a little bit on time. I know we're going to go a little bit over time in this section.
I'm too enthusiastic about those things.
Yeah, we wanted to start slow with those. We started with brushes and those things, wanted to give you a rundown of the tool. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to go under the hood. So stick around because we might go a little bit over. But these are really core fundamental concepts that you need to understand. So so bear with us as we switched. The last thing I want to mention is so SAMLPI is a tool. SAMLPI is a tool. We don't ship it out of the box with Microsoft, but you can go download it and use it with all of our apps, with any of our platforms.
Yeah, it's one of the tools coming from the great community around XAML, which is maybe also worth mentioning. There is a great community with great tools, great utilities, and a lot of content around that.
And if you don't, we also have a Visual 3 Helper API. So the platform does have a Visual 3 Helper API that you can use if you want to just dig into something or troubleshoot something. Or in some cases, sometimes you got to walk through your code. Sometimes you got to walk through your code.
Can we switch?
1 second. It's funny. I'm about... This thing keeps resetting every 3 minutes.
Yeah, we have a break. Small technical lock here.
We're in a break. We're good. So good. So that's the concept of the Visual 3, and that's a nice segue onto the next things that we're going to talk about. So let me go back here. And we're going to get into the next thing, which is resource and resource dictionaries. So I'm in the slide, so perfect. So you know, we just talked about the Visual 3. We've been talking about brushes, and we've been talking about shapes and things. And with resources, we kind of get into this concept of things that are reusable. If you saw one thing that Lorenz showed you is he showed you on phone the phone accent brush. Right, and that's a resource. That's something that's defined in one place, and everybody else can reference onto that. So we have this concept of resources, things that we're going to reuse across the board, and that's what I'm going to show you about. And these resources trickle up and down the Visual 3. So easiest to explain resources to just give you a little quick demo. So let me just go set a startup project here. What I have is an empty project here. It's pretty much blank app template. I just type a few things during the break, and I'm just going to copy and paste, or I'm going to uncomment them out. So here is just a standard window, nothing too exciting. And then I added a border and button. So we're going to talk about controls in a little bit. So don't worry. We started with shapes because we thought, hey, let's get them familiar with it.
But yeah, we're going to get into controls a lot. Building block of everything, really,
So here, for example, I went back and I said, look, I have this border. You know, with a background, and the background is red, and I can say here, this is interesting. This sample doesn't look right. All right, we'll improvise it as we go here. Let me go back to main page, resource sample. I must have opened the wrong project, but we'll improvise it here as we go. I'll type it a little bit again. So I have a border with a background. The background's red, and I have a margin. I have a button right here with a green. Am I in the right? I was just having the wrong scene.
Oh.
Now we're talking. I'm like, I typed these earlier.
Oh, because you have multiple projects.
I have multiple projects.
So you have multiple main pages. That's
so I don't have to type. So here, this is more like it. So I just have a stack panel, which is going to be a container. And I have a couple buttons here. And I'm just going to comment these out. And you'll see right how.
Control KU, right?
Yep, Control K, Control KU is the shortcuts. And you see here I have a stack panel with two buttons. And right now they don't have, you know, they're not the same background equals, and the brush does not yet exist. This is going to be used in resources. So let me show you the concept of a resource. So out here, I have this static resource lookup, which is going to go find a resource called local. And again, this is going to go up to Visual 3 and try to find this resource. So for example, here at my page, I'm going to go here and define these resources right here called local. And I just comment it in, and you see immediately that button now has a background. Right now, the other one that I have here has, you know, the other button is actually looking for a static resource called app. And these are just names that I picked. I could have named it anything. So let's just call it app 34 so you see these live. And I'm going to go back here into app.saml. And you see that it also has a resource dictionary. So I can just come back here and say, hey, the app, you know, this brush is going to be called app34, just so you see that I'm not cheating or anything like that, and do a save all. And now if I go back to that scene, making sure I find the right, the same one, you see that my button now is actually referencing that resource. Now think about it. This is at the application level. So the beauty of that is now I can have 100 buttons that are referencing that brush elsewhere,
correct,
and that brush is now being shared. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of resources. That's where we're going to use them. You're going to use them for everything, for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Just for context, I'll go back here, and I'll add another stack panel right next to it. I'll just comment this guy in. And he has the exact same structure where I have right here two buttons. And you see, first of all, static resource app right here is now broken because I renamed it to app34. So I just go back here, change it to app34.
And you have a nice experience with the squiggly lines.
The squiggly lines are there telling you the resource is not there.
Yeah.
At runtime, that would actually throw an exception.
That's
so
correct.
If I started that at runtime, it would just throw an exception saying, hey, you're off the rails.
And the exception is pretty good, actually. It
yeah,
tells you that this resource has not been found.
Yep,
so it's really
exactly
good. Yeah.
Now, something that's interesting is, check out these two. It's the exact same SAML. I have button referencing a local and then button reference app32, yet app34, yet they look different. And the reason for it is because, just to show you how the resources are looked up the tree, I inserted this, you know, every element, every UI element can have a resources collection, and I inserted this static panel.resources here with a, you know, one called local. So you can see here, if I make that go away, if this stack panel no longer has a resources collection, then it's green and pink, the exact same button. The reason for it is because these two stack panels are not in the same tree. These buttons right here are inside this, you know, stack panel over here, and they're not, they're siblings in the tree, but they're not up in the same visual tree. That's how we look things up through the visual tree. So you can come back here. Let me just comment it in. Let me just paste it back in, and you'll see my yellow come back as the scene
just
refreshes.
Just have to save, I
yep
guess. Yep.
And then the last thing that I'm going to show you here is I want to show you something else. Like, so this is resources. Brushes is one thing you're definitely going to use in resources a lot, but you can do anything in resources. You can just put any object you want to share. Mm-hmm. For example, here I have a resource called local person with a full name of Jaime, right? And you can see I can go back here to my buttons, and as I go back to my buttons right here, you see that inside that button right here, I actually have inside one of my buttons here, you see that I had a button, and the content right there is actually the resource person I can use. So I can come back here and leverage resources across the board. I could have made this anything else, right? Mm-hmm. It can be a person, it can be a data source, it can be anything else that mm-hmm I wanted to share across the board.
So if you zoom a little bit, you can see your name being drawn. And actually what
yep
happens here is that the content is going to call the toString method, right? Which
yep
is going
exactly
to, in that particular case, which of yep course you could customize to anything else.
So if
so
I
little
go
bit,
here,
a little bit,
yeah, the pink is
an
not
unusual
us
scenario, I would say, but this is something which yep illustrates well, yep, you know, that you can just take any object, put
yep
it inside there. Content needs something, so it's going to just do the immediate thing in .NET and call toString
yep
and that's
it. Exactly. And you see the pink here is not helping us. It's pink. It's white text on pink. But the beauty of resources, to show you what is interesting, is that the pink is app34.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I have just two buttons that are referencing. But so let's just go back here and make it blue. Right? So I'll come back here, change it in one place. Yep. And I just save it, you know, go ahead and save my stuff. And then when I go back to the right page, you see that it changed everywhere. And this is the beauty of resources, right? These and the ability to call onto those themes that you saw, like the phone theme and Windows Store apps will also have a light and a dark theme, is why we use resources. This is why resources will be a best practice for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the introduction to resources, why we do it. And the one thing for you to remember is how they're, you know, they're resolved looking up the visual tree.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw how the stack panel was looking up the page and everything else. That's exactly how we resolve them. One thing that we can also do is we have the concept. If you think about resources, you know, you might end up with many different resources. And one thing that we want to do is we want to organize them.
Sure.
Right. And everywhere that I've been using talking about resources, it's going to be like, hey, you know, how can we organize it? What can we put into them? So the first thing to look at here is, if I go back into the PowerPoint.
Okay, I think we lost your screen, actually.
She's
it's back.
Yep. So what are we going to do? We're going to put brushes, geometers. We're going to talk later about styles and templates. Those are things that definitely become resources.
Absolutely.
All the time. You want to parse them. You want to reuse them. You want to be able to make sure you share those as we go. Here's kind of a lookup after Visual 3 where, you know, from the element, the resource will, if it's not resolved there, it'll go up to the parent, to the, mm-hmm. you know, as many parents as we need, eventually to mm-hmm. the page, eventually to the app, and if it's not found there, and we also look up the system.
So in practice, I would say we typically place resources inside the page or inside the app. That's
exactly.
really the two practices that we do. And then we structure them in dictionaries, yep. like we will talk in a moment,
yep.
to make things neater. But this is, yeah, the two elements.
Yep.
I mean, putting a resource into an element is kind of, it makes it a little bit hard to find, I would say. So.
Yep, it's unusual, although if you have like a user control or something. But at that point,
could,
the user
yeah.
control is a container, very much
yeah,
like
exactly.
a page. So definitely, if you want to know where to put your resources, at the page level is very common.
Mm-hmm.
At the app level, you definitely want to put anything that's shared across the board. So
Correct.
You're definitely going to have to do that as you go. And then I can go back here and just very quickly show you. I can go back here and in my app.saml, you see that it's actually declared as a resource dictionary. My resources, I kind of use the verbose syntax and I declare it as a resource dictionary. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to show you I can come back here and say resource dictionary dot merge dictionaries, right? And then here, merge other dictionaries so that
exactly.
you can keep your stuff organized. You don't have to worry about source control and having this one very large
Correct.
Files. I can just say
you can
resource
have multiple
dictionary,
people working at the
you know,
same time.
And
on multiple resource dictionaries, not have the merge problem. You can organize your resources neatly.
Yep. Yep, and I won't create one here because that'll take me longer. I want to get back to it, but I can just uh-huh. go back here.
Yeah, the syntax
I can just
is
declare,
just, you said the
declare
source,
one.
It's a URI, which is relative
just,
to the root,
exactly.
and then you have it, yep.
Right, so I was going to create one, initially, but I'll just, so resource dictionary here, I can declare one here,
mm-hmm.
And I'll just say the source and add it, but I'm going to go back because I want to get,
sure.
we want to get caught up in time. But that's kind of how you keep them organized. So this is a best practice. Resources mm-hmm. is definitely a best practice, definitely a core concept that you need to get as we talk about mm-hmm. You know, WPF and under the hood and things that you're going to use.
Blend helps you also with some
yep.
dedicated UI to do these kind of things.
Yeah, you'll see that as we go
sure.
little bit later. And the next concept I want to introduce you is this whole concept. This is very, very much under the hood, but this is one of the core concepts that we have in WPF, which is dependency properties. One of the things that you will notice when you talk when you start doing WPF is that our buttons and our controls have these really kind of, I wouldn't say weird because it's going to look very familiar to .NET developers. You're going to be just accessing properties. But if you go under the hood, you will see that the syntax for properties is a little bit special. And the reason for that is because we have this special property system that uses this thing called dependency properties, right? And we're going to go here. It's easier to explain you a dependency property by giving you an example. These properties are going to use for styling, data binding. Let me give you an example of why, of how we use this, so you kind of get an idea. I'm just going to set as actually I start a project, and I'm going to go here. And this is the one that I was opening earlier. Now, this is the same scene that I opened earlier by mistake. Let me just show you here. Here's what we have. This is very simple. It's a border with a background is red and a button with a background of green. Nothing tricky here. Just two simple brushes. They could have been resources. Everything else that we talked about earlier would apply. Now, we're going to talk about styling next. Styling is a feature where very much like CSS, if you're familiar with CSS styles, you can kind of define a style that can set properties onto this object. And so let's just say I go back here, and at the page level where I normally put my resources, I define a style for all the buttons. By me just saying target type equals button, I'm defining a style that's going to be reused across the board. Again, styles are resources, as you can see here. And what you see here is this. We have a problem because this style is saying, hey, the background is going to be orange. Well, underneath it, we said the background was going to be green. So here's a conflict, right? We have two conflicting elements or two conflicting sources saying, hey, the property should be set to a specific value.
Correct.
Now, if I run this, if I just say startup and even run it right here in the simulator, you'll see that things get a little more interesting because I have the same thing. And right now, green is winning because that's the local value. Now, when I hover, it becomes transparent. And that's because the style is saying, hey, when the mouse is over this, you know, going to this other state where you become transparent. And for example, when I press, it becomes white.
Yep.
And again, these visual states are coming from the theme.
Sure.
Right? So the concept here is that we have a background, which is background is just a dependency property.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll show you in a minute how they're declared. You won't have to declare them on your own. You're just going to use them. I'm introducing you to the concept. But what we have here is we have all these sources that are trying to set the value,
yep.
right? And you can see here, for example, the local value, which is green, is winning over the style.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the animation is winning over everybody else.
Which is what you want,
so,
right?
Which
because
is what
the animation
you want.
Must actually appear.
Yep. And
exactly.
That's how dependency properties, that's why dependency properties exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have this special property system. And dependency properties is what we're going to use to power styles, binding, and animation, which we're going to talk about later.
Yeah,
in the
I used
day.
To say all the cool features of
exactly.
XAML rely on,
yep.
on dependency
now,
properties.
The big value properties is the value precedence. So there's a reference for these. You can find it. Just do a search for property value precedence on our Dev Center, and you will find the precedence, and you'll find explanation up here. But this shows you how complex dependency properties are. Right. Look at all the possible sources that can set a value. It can mm-hmm. come from validation or from an animation or a local value or style or, you know, theme. So there's lots and lots of values where it can come from. And the property system is actually doing or taking care of all of that for you.
Correct.
So that's a really great thing for you to actually be able to take advantage
uh-huh.
of.
And I would right? say that you can use dependency property in absolutely any object because it's just a feature of WPF or of,
yep.
of any other XAML framework. But because it is really very much UI-oriented, it probably makes more sense in the UI than anywhere else.
Yep.
And we tend to shy away from dependency properties in the model yep. and the data object, et cetera. But in the UI, my God, it's absolutely
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, in the
yeah.
UI. Now, this is a great segue onto this. So, As a person writing XAML apps, you're going to be consuming WPF all the time, or consuming dependency properties all the time.
Correct.
Everything with background, every property you interact with or UI is going to be a dependency property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you as a developer, you will hardly ever, unless you're a control vendor, you will hardly ever have to write dependency properties.
Correct.
So the way we look at it is I have this diagram here that says, look, here's how it works for us. We have a base class called dependency object that all of our element UI elements, framework element, controls, things that you're going to learn about in the next section are all inherited from. And, you know, the Microsoft guys creating the frameworks are actually inheriting from that and giving the dependency properties for you. If you have your class over here and all you're doing is consuming, you're just going to be setting and, you know, retrieving properties. You'll just be using standard syntax, and you'll see the syntax in a minute, and you're not going to have to do anything special. So let me show you kind of how you define them, which is going to give you a little bit how they're consumed anyway. To define a dependency property, this will be something that, let's say, we use for, this is actually going to be something we see in a later demo, where we have a special panel, like a radial panel. And it has the dependency properties of radios so that people can actually set that value of how big the radius is for our panel,
mm-hmm.
right? And you see here, the way we declare them is, you know, this verbose syntax, but it's really interesting, and there's a few things that we want to highlight for you. So you always declare them as static, right?
Absolutely.
That means they can be referenced from anywhere because we're almost going to use them as cookies into property bags. So that's why they're always declared as static. And you'll see here, you call dependency property.register. You give it the name of the property, the type. You tell it who the owner is going to be. This means that sometimes you can have, you know, somebody declare a property without being the actual, or a class declare a property that they're not the owner of. It's very unusual, but it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never do it, so ignore that part. I'm just telling you how it is. And then the one thing that we have is this property metadata, which one of them is the callback. And the reason this callback is important because, you know, the XAML engine, or our engine, is actually optimized such that if you write getters and setters for convenience,
mm-hmm.
the getters and setters are written for convenience. They're not necessarily written so that you can access the values there. So you will not write validation logic inside your getter and setter.
If you have, for example, right. an animation which is actually writing into the dependency property,
yep.
it's not, and you put a breakpoint in your setter,
in your
it's not actually
setter.
Going to hit, right? Because
yep.
this is only for convenience for human usage.
Yep. So this is how you declare them. You have the static read-only dependency property that you declare. And again, if you're not a control vendor, feel free to ignore that. And then when we declare them, we also give you this convenient syntax, which is they're declared as regular .NET properties. You
Correct.
See here, I have public double radios, and I have a getter and a setter. So you as a consumer, you're just going to be calling that getter and the setter. And if you want to know what's happening underneath, they're not doing anything. All they're doing is calling the get value and the set value, which are when methods that come from dependency object. Mm-hmm. And then that's actually triggering the change callback and all that. So we're going to be very, very effective about doing all of that. We're going to call it directly as much as we can, and we're going to take care of that for you. Mm-hmm. So this is dependency properties. You will consume them a lot. If you're not a control vendor, you'll hardly ever have to write some. When I get down later and I talk about custom panels, I'm going to show you panels. I'm going to give you source code to some panels, and you're going to see a lot of dependency properties there. Again, it's not something you do every day, but it's a concept that you mm-hmm. really have to understand, because later as we talk about styling and binding and all these things, we're going to tell you, oh, you can only style and bind dependency properties.
That's correct.
And then just to complete the context of dependency properties, we have this extra goodness called attached dependency properties. And this is a little bit of a special syntax where their properties, they're regular properties like the ones we did earlier, but these ones are attached. You use a special syntax so you can declare them. And let me show you a demo real quick of that so you can see here. So for example, here, I have my button right here. My border right here is inside a grid. And the grid is inside this grid that has two rows, right? And right now you see the border right now doesn't have anything that tells it where to go in the grid. So let me zoom out of the layout a minute. I can't zoom out. All right, so we'll just... Somehow I'm frozen. Oops.
Ah, here you go.
We're using remote desktop on two machines, so hopefully I'm still alive. All right, so I'll just scroll here because it seems to be okay. Mm-hmm. So I have the grid layout. It's my designer.
That's kind of, the designer has a small issue here.
I'm using the beta, so.
Yeah, it's 2013.
But you'll just see it disappear. Let me show you here how it's interesting. So this is a stack panel. This is a border with a button inside of it, and it's inside the grid. Now, what I want to do is I want to move this border onto the second row.
Uh-huh.
Now, so what I do here is I just grid. Oh, I'm really frozen.
You're running.
Oh, that's why. I'm like, this doesn't freeze this bad. Yeah, that's
okay, here you go.
Typing and talking is not my forte. So I can say grid.row equals mm-hmm. one. And that, if you see here, is just moving it onto the second row right here.
Right.
So you see that my grid right now is actually the first row is empty, right? So that's the beauty of grid. We have a panel, and this panel has row properties. Now, if this was a different kind of layout, like a radius panel, mm-hmm. like I told you earlier, then that will have a radius. It's mm-hmm. not going to have a row.
Sure.
Now, if you think about
think about the canvas. For example, you want to place a canvas with X and Y, right? Or top and left.
Canvas has top and left, yep.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't want to have to implement those properties on button, on border, on all the elements. So attaching them is really much more powerful.
If you remember Windows Forms, in Windows Forms, every element had a dock property, regardless of whether it was in the panel or not.
That's correct.
Well, here... through attached dependency properties, grid.row is an attached dependency property.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a special syntax, but here we have a property that's being set on the grid and is not a part of the border, but it's the border setting it.
Uh-huh.
And I can go back and query it onto the border. So
correct.
I can go into the border object, which is a dependency object, and say, give me your value for grid.row,
exactly.
and it's going to return me this value.
Yeah, it's kind of store on the object, which is going to be useful for the panel.
Exactly. And that's the concept of a dependency attached dependency property. Again, if you're not a control vendor, this is even more advanced than regular dependency properties. So you'll never declare one of these. I've written plenty of projects where I never declare an attached mm-hmm. dependency property. Unless you're doing like a custom layout, you won't get there.
Uh-huh.
But this is a concept that you should be familiar. Now, look at the syntax. We have something very similar, static declaration for the attached property. Now, here we did register attach instead of register, right? And now notice, because these are not at the element level, I don't have standard CLR getter and setter.
Yep.
I actually have this special convention that we use set row and get row.
Which are static,
Which are static. And then we're passing the dependency object that we're going to set it.
Correct.
So, for example, here I would set row. The dependency object would be border, and the value would be 1, and that's how I would be setting it, mm-hmm. right? And that's the concept of our dependency property. And then we have one more concept, and then we'll give you a break. I know we're behind today, but these are the core under the hood fundamental concepts. So there's one more that I want to give you, and then I'll give you a break. I promise. And this is routed events. We talked about the Visual Tree, right?
Yes.
So. And everybody knows what an event is. You saw me do a click event earlier. And we have this concept of, hey, there's eventing that's going to happen. And something that we could do is route the events up the Visual Tree, very much like we did the resource lookup. We can up route the events up the Visual Tree so that, you know, parents in the hierarchy can listen to these events and be aware of them.
Correct.
Now, we have two types of router events. When it comes to SAML platform, we tend to talk about tunneling and bubbling. Silverlight and Windows Store desktop is going to bubble, which means the events are going to go up the tree. So from where they happen all the way up the tree until somebody handles, you'll see them at the demo in a minute. In WPF, they also do tunneling.
Yeah.
So you go up and then down.
Which is really awesome because you actually know that the event is going to happen before it actually happens, which is really... If it doesn't blow your head, I don't know what will.
But, you know, with going up the tree, you get a lot of the flexibility. You get a lot of the functionality. So you're going to still be able to accomplish a lot. So let me go here and give you a really quick example of event routing.
So, for example, a practical event for even bubbling, right? If you think that, okay, I have a list control, and inside this list I have a button somewhere, and I want to know at the page level that any of those elements has been clicked, well, you can just listen to the routed event at the page level, and then you don't have to worry about where do I declare my event handling.
So I have a little SAML that I already, by the way, all the SAML, all the stories that we're showing you, we're going to give you.
Of course.
You can look all these up and references when we do the video. But I have this little SAML, and they're big like that so that you could see them. And I use the bold color so you can see them. And it's kind of what this looks like. This has a grid. And it's got a border, red borders called right here. And inside that border, so this is a visual tree that we're creating. We have a yellow border inside there. And then from there, we have a stack panel that's actually the green panel. So this is where the green are coming from. And then underneath, I have two buttons, right? And so there's going to be a lot of, like, if you click on a button, there should be things, events. Or if I mouse over any of these, there will be events that are going back and forth. And what I've done here is, for all of these elements, I've just registered to handle the pointer press event. Pointer press is what we use in Windows Store because that way we can handle touch, mouse, and keyboard, or in this case, touch and mouse with the exact same event. So this is the pointer press is kind of the replacement to your mouse down equivalent. And they're all listening to this pointer press. And then what I did for the event handler is I just have something that says, hey, this event was clicked right here. Here's the on pointer press. And all we're saying, hey, let me tell you what event was clicked, what the name of the element that was clicked, that's handling it right now, and where the pointer press originated at, which is the source, right? And you see here it's a routed event. We have pointer router event. Rx is the type because we're talking about router events. So let me just show you this real quick on the simulator. And I'll show you some of what we did. So, for example, let's go. It again. It goes up the visual tree. So let me go here. At this resolution, it's hard to show.
That's a real, real treat.
So I can go here, make the simulator a little bit smaller.
XAML and Blend are great excuses to get a second monitor, by the way.
Yep.
So tell your boss, you know, I'm doing XAML, I need a second monitor now because
I'm a visual guy now. I started a Twitter campaign on Monday. I send people say, are you using two or three monitors? And I'm actually going to use that with my boss. I'm going to be like, hey, I need a third monitor. And I want all of them to be 27-inch.
Very cool.
That's why I started it. So if you haven't, if you follow me or if you go to my Twitter, reply with that. You have to have three monitors, Jaime, because I'm going to use that with my boss next week. But let me walk you through. So I have the simulator here, and here's my output window. And this will just take one more minute. And I can go back here to the output window. And you can see here what's happening. If I click over here where the red border... you see that the red border pointer press happened, and it's originated at red border because it's going up the tree. So now if I just leave it like that, I'm going to click on the yellow. And you see here now yellow border pointer press originated at the yellow border. And you see that the yellow border is listening and the red border is listening to it. If I continue to go down the green panel, same thing, right? Green panel, it's telling you it originated green panel, and then yellow and red, they get it. Right, because these events are routing. Now, things get interesting here when I get down to the button.
Oh yeah.
Check out what happens when I click on the button. Nothing. The event didn't route up. The reason for that is because button is handling the event and saying, hey,
it's saying I took care of it.
I took care of it. I'm gonna mark it handled. I'll show you in a minute how to mark it handled, and nobody's listening to it. right? So if you go here, for example, you see that
which kind of makes sense because the button really is really the clickable element by
exactly
you know, by,
so they,
by nature.
The button
right?
doesn't want anybody else to listen and to handle it
typically,
because they're
yeah.
going to handle it.
Yeah.
Now here, for example, what I did is in that exact same code on the on pointer press, I added an extra code that says, look. Here's how you mark a handle. You have a pointer router event args, and there's an e.handle property. So I'm going to say, look, if this checkbox, this checkbox that's in the UI is checked, go ahead and handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I can go back here and say, oh, well, now earlier, like if we're doing now, I click on the yellow border, and let's just clear here. I click on the yellow border, and you'll see that it routes fine, yellow and then red. Now, mm-hmm. I'm going to check the handle, and let's say I click on the green. Right, so green, yellow, red mm-hmm. should get it. Well, when I click on it, green gets it,
yep.
And it's executing this code. Green is marking it as handled, and nobody else gets
correct.
It anymore. Right, so that's the concept of router events mm-hmm. that it will bubble up the visual tree until somebody handles it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, over here, red is very dominant. So red is like kind of saying, "Look, I'm your daddy. I need to know regardless."
Everything.
Exactly.
At
so
what
we do here is the
outing.
Red border can go back. We have this extra handler where we this extra method that we can do. So I can just stop here, and the red is going to say, you know what? I'm going to add a handler, and the third parameter here is, do you want it even if somebody else has already handled it,
mm-hmm.
right? And red is saying, hey, I want to listen to that. Kind of to your example, mm-hmm. if I have a stack panel that has 20 buttons.
Yeah.
And I just want to handle the click in one place, I mm-hmm. can just handle it here.
Correct.
Right? If it was a routed event. So I can go back here. Red is saying, hey, I'm going to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now I can go back, added a handler. The extra handler is just going to output very similar mm-hmm. to what we did, but it has something that begins with extra. And so I can go back
so
here.
So this add handler syntax, which is a little bit more complicated to write, there are shortcuts where you don't need to write the whole thing. Like, for example, click equals hello world or click. In C sharp, you write click plus equals and then the thing. If you want the extra power of getting the handle
yep.
event, then you use the add handler
yep.
method.
And
right.
the add handler has to be done from code. This is one of those few
that's
things
correct.
That cannot be done from sample.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of an interest. Now with certain techniques, you could definitely do it from SAML call onto a behavior or do some other things.
I guess
but,
so.
But this is one of those things that you have to do from code. So just to finish this subject, this demo right here. So I have everything routing. I click on the green panel. It will route the exact same way. Now I click on handled, and you'll see nothing. You'll see it's not routing.
It's routing,
but you see
but the
that
red
the green
got
panel
it, right.
got it. And the yellow didn't get it, and then the red got that extra handler
it
that
says,
it subscribed
I want everything.
To. So now it's listening to everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's the concept of routed events. Again, this is why visual trees are so important, because everything we do in SAML is mm-hmm. going to go up and down the visual
yeah.
tree.
And like you mentioned before, yep. there are visual tree helpers. We don't have a demo for that, but you can actually, from the code, say, hey, go up the tree until you find an element of type border, until you find an element of type grid, for
yep.
example, and,
yep.
and do things like that for very advanced scenarios, I
yep.
would say.
If you look at the demo code that I gave you, and I didn't show this to save a little bit of time, but if you look at the demo code that I showed you earlier with the resources sample, you will see these. I had this sample on how to resolve a resource from source. So I had this sample right here where I had a rectangle that I could add, inject it onto the tree. And then I say, look, try to find the resource. And this is actually going to go back up the tree and kind of walk through it. It doesn't show you Visual Tree Helper. I have a different sample for Visual Tree Helper. So
sure.
we'll make sure we include those up
okay.
in the sample code.
Absolutely.
So that's something that we'll definitely give people the examples for. Now, the last thing real quick, in this same topic, in the second to last slide, is that not all of events route. Right, so there's this very specific set of events, in Silverlight, we have key down, key up, focus, mm-hmm. And you see a lot of the mouse events routing.
Correct.
Now, as we move to Windows on phone, you'll see that we kind of migrated away from those from mouse events, and we moved on to pointer
touch.
Events because yeah. those will handle touch
exactly.
and mouse in the exact same event. So you don't have to know whether something came out of a pen or you know, mouse or touch, you just say, look, I just want to know if something was pressed.
Well, you can know if you want to handle it specially, but if in most cases you don't want to know, actually.
Yep, and if you handle like a pointer, like if you do a pointer press event args, it will tell you the source, so you can say this came from a pen or from a mouse.
Or from a mouse, exactly.
Or something like that. So not all the event routes, here's the list, and you can go back and look at the reference. You saw me look at router event args. The main thing with router events args is the handler property that you see.
Correct.
And we're over, so we're not going to take Q&A because we're a bit over, and then we're going to give them a 10-minute break. And then we'll come back. You know, why don't we do it like this? Why don't we come back to layout? No, do you want to do controls or layout? Because layout will be half an hour, and then we can do lunch.
Yeah, we can improvise this way.
Yeah, so let's improvise it where we go back and we do layout in half an hour, in 20 minutes, so we can have lunch at noon like we promised. And then we'll do control afterwards because that's a simpler one.
Yeah, no problem.
And that was our... We knew that one was going to take us longer because there was a lot of fundamentals and a lot of really, we wanted to start slow and give you a good tour of blend. So for the rest, I think we won't be as far over. So, all right, we'll see you in 10 minutes.
All right.
Yep, thanks.
Have fun.